This is Digital Story Podcast number 546, August 23rd, 2016. Today's theme is The Black and White Project. I'm Derek Story. Over the past few days, I've been seeing the world in black and white. How, you may ask? It's been through the viewfinder of my Olympus OMD EM5 Mark II, set in monochrome mode. And as a result, I saw the rugged landscape of Point Reyes in a whole new way. And what I discovered during this process, I discuss in today's podcast. I had toyed with this idea earlier, but after spending the entire day scouting for the TDS Point Reyes workshop, and that's what I do, I go out usually a day or two before, and the reason why I do that one last one, you know, way back when, we do all sorts of scouting and reconnaissance and all that stuff. But I do another scouting trip right before the workshop because guess what? Things change. They do. And you don't want to discover things have changed, you know, with eight sets of eyes looking at you. So anyway, yeah. So I go out the day before and I just see how things are before we embark on the workshop the next day. And that's a very interesting process for me. I like that day, in addition to feeling a lot more comfortable about what may happen with the workshop itself. It gives me a chance to take some pictures and think about, okay, what are the themes, you know, for this event that we're going to be doing over the next few days? And I usually try to come up with, you know, one or two projects that would be fitting for people to try during the workshop itself. So as I was wandering around on the trails around Tomales and Point Reyes, you know, it's a very interesting landscape. This time of year in California, all the grasses are this golden brown, but they have highlights, especially the tall grasses where they have some seeds at the top. The seeds are lighter than the grass stalks, and it really looks pretty in the breeze, and there's almost always a breeze coming off the bay or coming off the ocean, depending on where you are. There can be clouds in the sky. There weren't on this particular weekend, but there can be, and those are quite beautiful also. And then there are these rugged rocks, and sometimes they're very large rock formations, sometimes smaller ones, but they are scattered throughout the landscape, along with pockets of water, marshes. You know, it's really interesting. And as I looked at this landscape, I was thinking, this could be very nice in black and white. And especially on the foggy mornings and the way the weather cycle is in Northern California this time of year. On the coast, the fog usually rolls in sometime during the night. And it lingers until, I don't know, usually around midday. And then it will burn off. And then you'll get whatever you're going to get in the second half of the day. Usually pretty nice weather, though. So I knew that for this workshop, we'd have very foggy mornings. And we'd have this interesting landscape. And I thought, boy, you know, black and white could be really nice for this. So I came up with the idea of doing the black and white project over the course of the workshop. And I did it, and a few others did it also. I'll talk about that more in a few minutes. And essentially, what I did was set up my camera so that I could see the world in black and white and photograph in the world in black and white. So I'm going to go over some of those aspects right now, some of the things I learned and how I set up my camera, because you could do this project in all sorts of places, or you could do a spin-off of it also using these same techniques. I don't know. It's just one of those things that shakes up your photography just enough to get the juices flowing, if you know what I mean. So I have five key elements that I'll discuss right now, and then you know, we'll see where we end up after that. The project works best for people who have mirrorless cameras with electronic viewfinders. I think this is really important. Now, for instance, almost all DSLRs now have a live view mode on the back LCD. The problem is, you know, when you're working outside, composing and working off the back LCD is not a very satisfying experience, whereas looking through an electronic viewfinder is much nicer. So mirrorless have a leg up because a standard DSLR with an optical viewfinder can't show you the world in black and white, whereas a mirrorless camera in monochrome mode, when you look through the electronic viewfinder, you literally see black and white. Electronic viewfinders, I tell you, they're a big part of what I consider, you know, this mirrorless revolution that we're in right now, because there are all sorts of aspects to mirrorless photography that are appealing. This weekend, one of the aspects that was highly appealing to me was the electronic viewfinder itself that allowed me to play with this project and actually see the world according to the settings that I had made for the camera. It kind of reminds me way back when I was shooting film only. I wanted to shoot black and white. I loved black and white, and I was using it for sports photography and for my reporting, but I wanted to shoot outdoor landscape photography while I was hiking. And I was having a really hard time sort of looking at the world and then figuring out if that would be a good black and white shot or not. So they had this thing, I don't know if any of you know about this, but it was this weird thing that you could hold up to your eye. It was a disc with a filter in the middle of it, very dense filter. And when you held it up to your eye and you look through it, you close the other eye and you look through it, it would give you this sort of monochromatic view of the world. And it wasn't straight black and white. It was sort of a greenish tint, as I recall. And it was very dense, and so it was really hard. You kind of had to squint your eye and look through it. The idea of it was to help you preview the scene to determine if it were going to be a good black and white shot or not. And I remember I bought one of those things, and I had it for a while. I don't have it anymore, which is unusual because I usually have most of that weird stuff I had in those days. You know, I would say that I had a love-hate relationship with this accessory, but it was mostly hate. It was just so dense, and it was just, I don't know. Whatever little bit of inspiration I had at the moment, I lost it when I was, you know, trying to look at the scene through this disc and determine if this greenish dim thing I was seeing was worth shooting or not. So now fast forward all these years to mirrorless photography and having these wonderful, fantastic, high-resolution electronic viewfinders that instantly reflect whether we're doing exposure compensation in plus or minus, or in this case, applying some sort of effect, such as monochrome, instantly through that viewfinder, we can see what's in front of us according to those settings. And that is a heck of a lot better than that stupid disc I used way back when. So I think that was a key to this project. Now, not everyone that comes to my workshop shoots mirrorless. We usually have about half and half, DSLR and mirrorless. But those that did have mirrorless had, I thought, a real leg up on this because they didn't have to shoot off the LCD and they could preview it in the electronic viewfinder. Now, the next key aspect to this, in my opinion, is shooting RAW plus JPEG. And the reason why I say that is because as wonderful as black and white is, I don't necessarily, you know, want every shot for the weekend, for the entire workshop, to be limited to black and white. And especially true if I were coming to this workshop as a participant and had been waiting all year to go to this, and then just come away with black and white only. I mean, that's really out on a wire, right? So the nice thing about RAW plus JPEG and the mirrorless cameras in particular is that the JPEGs reflect the settings that you have for the filter, for the monochrome filter, yet you still get RAW files that are full color and have, you know, everything that the camera has to offer. So it is a heck of a safety net. Now, what you're seeing through the electronic viewfinder is black and white. What you see on the LCD when you review the image is black and white because it's showing you the JPEG. So what happens then when I go to upload these images to Capture One Pro is I actually do two uploads. So the first upload will be just the JPEGs, and I filter those in the import. You know, you can sort by extension, so all the JPEGs will show up at the top. So I just bring in the JPEGs and I put those in an album inside my Point Reyes projects, and it'll be black and white JPEGs for day one. And then I do a second import in a second album that is the raw files for that very same day. And I just keep them all nice and tidy in a project. But by the time I'm done with the weekend, the project will have albums for the raws each day and for the JPEGs each day, and then my three stars and all that kind of stuff. The RAW plus JPEG is really helpful in terms of allowing me to have color shots in addition to the black and white. For those of you that shoot Olympus, you can go to super fine for the JPEG. Now, originally when you look in your menu, your compression menu for JPEG files, you'll see fine as the highest setting. But if you dig around in the menus, you go a little deeper, it'll allow you to find super fine. And you can say, hey, I want super fine as an option. And that's what I do when I'm doing this. So I'll have full resolution JPEGs at super fine compression. These are very high quality files. And I'm not giving up a whole lot compared to the RAWs. So I'm getting a very high quality black and white image. And then, of course, the RAW file itself. So RAW plus JPEG, I think, is really a key part of this process. Third point. The actual shooting experience. With the absence of color, I found it easier to work with the various elements in the composition, and I thought this was really interesting. It makes a lot of sense to me now that I say it, now that I've experienced it, but I didn't really think about this part of it going into the project. But by removing the color from the scene in front of me as I look through the viewfinder, it was a lot easier for me to work with light and darks, and to work with the various elements in the photograph. And I thought the composition was really enjoyable because you're just looking at this and you go, I got a rock here. I got these continuous tones here. I've got a tree here. You know, and they were just like these things, you know, like these moving pieces almost that I could, by moving to the left, to the right, up or down, really get everything exactly the way that I wanted. And not having, quote, the distraction of color, end quote, really was a real thing. And I thought that was fascinating. And I left it on black and white for the whole workshop. I never took it off. No matter how luscious or how beautifully colorful the scene was in front of me, I stayed in that black and white mode, and it really forced me to think about the elements in the scene and not be distracted by the color. That part, it was worth doing it just for that part alone. Along with that, and the next point is that this was a good technique to help me slow down a bit. And when I'm shooting my everyday life, when I'm working on the blogs and all the publishing that I do, I tend to work very quickly because I have a lot to do. I have a lot of sites. I have a lot of interesting things I want to cover, and I got to get them posted and move on to the next thing. And so sometimes that mode carries over into my recreational shooting. And really, I don't want to be in that frame of mind for my recreational shooting. I want to slow down a bit. I want to be a little bit more thoughtful in my work. This process of putting things into black and white and really enjoying the different elements of the shot and the lights and darks and everything caused me to slow down. Suddenly I was, you know, really looking at the scenes. I was really enjoying the scenes. I was thinking about it. Now, sometimes, like if a bird came up on a bush, well, then boom. Yeah, I'm not thinking about that. I'm shooting the shot, right? Yeah. So anything that involved wildlife or things that moved, I would still react as I normally would. But the other things, shooting the architecture, the old buildings, the marshes, you know, all that kind of stuff, I slowed down a lot. And I thought this really helped me do that. And I thought that was another side benefit that I hadn't really thought about would be a part of it, and yet really was something that I enjoyed. Now, on the computer itself, I found it very interesting to see which shots I liked better in black and white and which shots I did in color. Now, I did the original sorts with the black and white. So I would work all in black and white in terms of two stars, three stars, that kind of thing. Then what I would do is I would, you know, narrow that album to just the 3-star shots. And then I would go through the color images, and then I would do a rate there also, and then create another album of 3-star color shot. And there was very little overlap. So the 3-star black and white shots tended to be all different than the 3-star color shots in the raw file album. In a sense, I think that surprised me, because my thinking, at least before this, would be that a 3-star shot is a 3-star shot, whether it's in black and white or it's in color. It didn't really turn out that way, because color or the black and white effect on the shot really was pronounced and had a huge influence on the emotional impact that the shot had for me. And that's a lot of times what I go off. I mean, I count on having good composition, good exposure, all that kind of stuff. That should be the baseline, hopefully, for everything that I shoot. So then what I'm looking for when I'm doing the star ratings is the emotional impact of the shot. How do I feel about it? Do I feel anything, or does it just leave me flat? That is where the color of black and white really came into play in a much different way. And when it was all said and done, I probably had 3 or 4 shots that made it into that 3-star folder in both color and black and white. Everything else was different. And that was fascinating to me. So then it got me thinking, by not doing this all the time for my recreational photography, how many good shots am I, you know, leaving behind that are there on my computer that maybe if I converted them to black and white, I would have something that I really liked. Now, what other folks did with this is some did it the way that I did. They shot. And then others, what they would do is they would shoot everything in RAW, in color, of course, and then do conversion in Lightroom or whatever they were using to black and white for their black and white shots. One photographer, he did all black and white, and he did it this way. He shot everything in color and then converted certain shots to black and white. And then some of the photographers would integrate a few black and whites into their presentation. And we have this presentation at the end of every one of my workshops is where people present 6 to 8 shots from the weekend and discuss them. And almost everyone had at least one black and white shot in there. Most of the time, it was something they shot with color and then converted. So we had people doing all sorts of different approaches. The approach that I think is fun to play with as we put a bow on this here is that if you want the other benefits that I'm talking about, looking through the viewfinder and seeing the world in black and white, really noticing how the compositional elements jump out at you more without the distraction of color, and slowing down a bit maybe as a result, then I would try shooting in monochrome with the RAW plus JPEG format. It's something just to put out there, and especially here we are now, we're getting near the end of summer. It would be fun to have a new project or two as we, you know, roll into fall before we get into fall color and all that stuff. If you're looking for something to play with during what we call in baseball anyway, right, the dog days before fall gets here, then consider this project, because I found it really satisfying. Now, I have some of the shots posted on the digital story. I wrote a companion article to this feature on the podcast. So you can go over there, you can look at the shots. I put them on my Flickr page. If you follow me on Flickr, then they're right there. And if you want to know how to get to any of this stuff, right, it's thedigitalstory.com. And then Facebook, Flickr, all that stuff, that's up in the nav bar. And the way that I label Flickr is my photo gallery, because that is my photo gallery. Just click on that, you'll go over there. But take a look at some of these shots and see what you think. In the news, how to figure out what to charge for your next portrait assignment. And this is an article on the Phoblographer. I'm going to talk about it for a second. And then if you're interested in this, I would recommend that you go over to the Phoblographer. I have the link in the show notes and read the entire article. But I think this is a challenge for freelancers and emerging pros alike. How much do you charge for a portrait shoot? I think the key is to analyze all the steps involved in the project and the time that it takes to accomplish them, and then try to attach some sort of dollar amount to that in Denver. Now, basically, I divide my shoots into 3 categories: preparation, the actual shoot time, and post-production. And you have to account for all of those. You can't just account for the actual shoot time, because you're doing stuff before, And I know you're going to do stuff afterwards, and all of that has to be rolled in there. And don't let potential clients bully you in this area, saying, hey, the shoot was only 2 hours. Why are you charging me $700? That's more than a lawyer makes. And you go, yeah, I'm only here for 2 hours. That's true, but I'm going to spend 2 hours before and probably 4 hours afterwards. That's more like 8 hours. And believe me, $700 for 8 hours of this type of work is very reasonable. I'd be very nice in my response. But, you know, I can talk freely with you, right? All right. And then there's other stuff, too. You need to consider consultation time. And some clients, you spend more time talking with them than others. Travel costs. And then your gear investment itself, not to mention any insurance that you have on it and protecting your gear. For instance, one thing that came up in the article is traveling with $3,000 worth of gear for a New York City shoot. Probably not going to take the subway, probably going to take Uber. And it'll cost a little bit more, and you probably want to put that in there, but it also helps you protect your gear. If you've been kind of wrestling with this, you've been thinking about, you know, how do I charge appropriately for my work, then take a look at this article on the Foodblogger. I think it's really helpful. He breaks down a lot of different categories and really talks about it in a very business-like way. So something fun to think about for those of you that are out there freelancing or just starting your pro business. I want to pick up the story on the Hedge free license because actually this is part of a bigger picture that I'll be talking about for the next couple weeks now. Just to refresh, Hedge is an app for the Mac, and it's the fastest app for importing and backing up media. You can import multiple sources to multiple destinations at the same time. And every file copied by Hedge is cross-verified with the original. So it's software that is blazing fast and really helpful for, in this case, what we're talking about is moving files from your media card, from your camera's media card, into your photo management system on your computer. Now, the reason why I'm putting it in this context is because what the guys at Hedge are looking at is how can we better integrate Hedge with Lightroom? Because the one thing that we hear about Lightroom is that the import has really slowed down. And this came up a lot this last weekend at the workshop. I would say probably a little over half of the workshop participants are using Lightroom, and none of them are satisfied with the import process, and each of them brought it up at one time or another. So what the folks at Hedge are doing is how do they take the software that they've developed and better integrate it with Lightroom? So they have a 10-day free license for the pro version, for the top-of-the-line version. All you have to do is go to hedgeformac.com, hedgeformac.com/TDS. Download it, get the free 10-day pass, and then just take a look at it. Give it a test run. See how it performs. You know, move things, you know, off your media card onto your Mac. Play around with it. Look at the features and interface. And if you're a Lightroom user, then think about how would you want this integrated with your Lightroom experience? Would you want to be a plug-in for Lightroom? Would you want to bring the images onto their destination first with Hedge and then just point your Lightroom catalog over to that? You know, just kind of, you know, think about the different scenarios. And then I'm going to ask for your feedback in the next week or so. Then we're going to give that to the Hedge guys and see what they can come up with for us. So this is really exciting stuff because, you know, we're getting to be involved with the evolution of this product. It's a very good product right now, but if we can help relieve this pain point that Lightroom users are having, that would be fantastic. So anyway, it's hedgeformac.com/TDS. If you're interested in participating in this and providing feedback, go download the app now, have the free trial, and then we'll revisit this next week, and I'll talk a little bit more about some of the possibilities for Lightroom and see what they can come up with for us. Here's a story that I thought was a good story. I was happy to see it. It's on Petapixel, and the headline is, SmugMug is helping save 200 million photos lost when Picture Life died. And, you know, when Picture Life went down, it went down, boom, abruptly, and there was no transition for its users. So let me read you what's on the Petapixel site right now. When photo storage site Picture Life shut down, users were left high and dry without a way to access or download the images they had stored there. This didn't sit well with SmugMug, who reached out to Picture Life and today is helping reunite those photographers with their lost images. In all, some 200 million files were lost into the ones and zeros of internet history when Picture Life went under. But out of this sad tale came 200 million opportunities for SmugMug to be both altruistic and maybe snag a customer or two for themselves. It's important to note, however, that it will cost you nothing to take advantage of this offer from SmugMug. It's something that SmugMug was very adamant about. So you can read more about this, and if you were a Picture Life customer and your images, you know, went down the drain with everyone else's when Picture Life went under, then go over to the Petapixel article. I have the link in the show notes, and then there's all the information that you need there. There's also a link to go to the SmugMug assistance that will help you retrieve your photos today and get them back. I just thought this was cool. And yes, I mean, we know that SmugMug realizes that they may get some additional customers out of this, but I tell you, this is a lot of work they're doing and there's absolutely no strings attached. And they are absolutely trying to help folks retrieve their photos. And if it puts them in a good light, well, you know what? It should. All right, just a couple final updates before we wrap up today's show. I want to let you know that the fourth episode of the Nimble Photographer podcast is now posted for our Patreon supporters. And if you wish to join the inner circle and support this show and receive the Nimble Photographer podcast, the first season of the Nimble Photographer podcast, just click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. And it's a very easy URL. It's patreon.com/thedigitalstory. You can listen to excerpts from the shows. I have the fourth episode. I got a nice, really nice, like 5 minute. It's a good story that I put up. So you can listen to that. And if you decide that you want to support the show and get the first season of the Nimble Photographer podcast, guess what? You can do that right there also. I'm sure that's a surprise to you, right? And all the folks that have signed up to support the Digital Story and have become part of our inner circle at Patreon, thank you so much. I can't tell you how appreciative I am. And finally, a big tip of the hat to the folks over at Red River Paper. It was interesting, after I brought up the notion last week that I'm working on a way for Capture One users to easily create fine art greeting cards right there in Capture One, Drew over at Red River Paper, he wrote me and he said, "That's interesting because I've had a couple of questions about that lately and I didn't really know how to answer it." And he says, I want to help those guys out. I just don't know how. And, you know, he's not a Capture One user himself. You know, I think this is going to be a cool thing. I talked about it a little bit this weekend when we were doing the class presentation. Certain images would come up and I'd go, that would be a great fine art greeting card. Some images, they just say fine art greeting card right on them. You know, they're just like perfect. And you can just see someone, you know, opening up the envelope and pulling this thing out on this beautiful paper, you know, that feels good to the hands and going, oh my gosh, this is the most beautiful card I've seen. And then turn it over and see your name on the back that you created this. I mean, that is a cool thing. When I brought this up, it was so funny in the workshop. And I'd say, that would be a great fine art greeting card. And then someone invariably would say, on Red River Paper. And I'd go, you're darn right. Because that's the only paper that I use. Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. And they have a tile on all the pages. They're into this and they're into photography. And they really appreciate you also supporting them by using their products. All right, well, that's going to do it for today. I have to tell you, I had a fantastic weekend out there in Point Reyes with our TDS members. Workshops are so invigorating. I think I'm going to bring this one back next year too, because, you know, we have this fantastic location. We all stay together in this giant ranch house. This is the first time we've actually all lived together during a workshop. And I have to say, it adds yet another pleasing dimension to the whole thing. So I'm still on a high from it. And those of you that are listening that attended, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed working with you and for a short period of time living with you. Yeah, it was pretty cool stuff. So anyway, next week, I've got some more good topics in the hopper. Make sure you come back and join me. Until then, have a great week. Think about this project that I talked about. Do something creative. Get that end of your summer supercharged, and then we'll have a head of steam as we roll into the fall. All right, until then, bye-bye now.